I hope you'll see in a little while why that song is very applicable to what we want to talk about this morning. Turn over to Job chapter 1 in just a few minutes. We'll be looking at some things from the life of Job. I was talking to my granddaughter a couple days ago. I think it was yesterday, actually. And we were talking about future plans, things foreseeing the future and wondering what's going to happen in the future. And finally, I just typed out a little Spanish statement, que sera, sera. How many know what que sera, sera means? A few of you do. Some of you are nodding. Que sera, sera means what will be, will be. There's a song written in 1955. Doris Day sang it, and some of you will know this. She sang it. It was actually background to a movie, The Man Who Knew Too Much, which is a Hitchcock movie. And Doris Day sang that song in 1956. My mother sang it almost every day after that. And every time that I would raise some question, I was a little bit of a worrywart when I was a kid, so anytime Mom just kind of ran out of answers or attempting to answer, she would just say, que sera, sera. Sometimes she would break out in song. And so I learned this really well. The rest of that song, I'm not going to do the whole thing here, but the rest of the song, the next line is, the future's not ours to see. So, que sera, sera, whatever will be, the future's not ours to see. So what I want you to think about this morning is that true? Is the future not ours to see? It is true, except for 2 Timothy 4, 7, and 8. And I told you to turn to Job, but I'm going to read this first. You don't have to go there if you want. But in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7, Paul says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. He was alive when he said this. I need to remind you of that. Henceforth, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. So the future is not ours to see in the sense that we know it's going to happen even 30 minutes from now or this afternoon. But it is ours to see because God has given us this vision of what is to come. And that vision is one that we have by faith. There's an old saying, faith is not knowing what the future holds, but who holds the future. I think that's a worthwhile thing to think about. Who holds the future? We know God holds the future. We don't know, of course, what the future holds. So Job, I think, if we think about this, having a farther along attitude, thinking about what we just sang about, farther along, we'll know all about it. Farther along, we'll understand why. One of the best examples, and perhaps the poster child for developing this farther along attitude, is the faithful Job, who went through so much. We're going to look at the book of Job this morning. So in chapter 1, I'm going to talk a little bit at first, and I'm kind of go through. I know a lot of you are very familiar with his life. We studied this during COVID, some of us did, and that was one of the, I felt, one of the most enjoyable studies we ever went through. And we went through everything. We didn't go from just chapter 1 and 2 and then jump all the way over to chapter 38. We actually went through all the friends' discussions and conversations and all that, and it was really an enjoyable study, I would suggest it. Job had a very cushy life, as we'll see. Look at verse 1 through 5. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. So I'm just going to stop there for a minute, because what God is telling us through this book is that Job was a special man, not because he had all the stuff. I mean, he had enough stuff to probably open a clothing store. He had all the sheep and stuff, and he was a farm. You know, he kind of could run a tremendous farm because he had all those oxen to do plowing for him. He had enough stuff to single-handedly keep the economy of us buzzing for quite a while. And he just had a lot of, he just was very, very rich. He was the greatest man in the East, we're told. He was also charitable. Turn over to chapter 29, because we're not going to be looking at that, all the insides of Job this morning, but there are some interesting things we want to point out. In Job 29, verse 12, when he's making his defense, this is after all his problems are set in, he says this, "Because I delivered the poor who cried for help and the fatherless who had none to help him. The blessing of him who was about to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy." In other words, besides having all this stuff, being the greatest man of the East, and being, he was truly a righteous man, he even helped those who needed help. So Job was prosperous. He was generous. He was as righteous as any man we could mention. There's a fly in the ointment, though, and that's this que sera, sera business. That's the idea that whatever will be, will be. That's true in the next moment. I mean, whatever will be, will be. It's going to happen. We have so little control over things. And so, like so many of us, I think Job was waiting for the next shoe to drop. I don't know the background to that statement, but I have a feeling maybe somebody is in a room below in the hotel and saying a shoe drops and they're waiting. Okay, before I can go to sleep, I gotta wait for that next shoe to drop. I don't know. But we know what this means. We live on this, in this uncertainty. And we don't know exactly what's going to happen. When people ask me, I've told you this before, and people ask me, "How are you doing?" I say, "Fine, as far as I know." Because I don't know what might come in the near future or even the less near future. So it is, it comes back to this. What will be, will be. This is how we live our life. This is how we have to live our life. Job covered all the bases. He even sacrificed for his children, we learn in verses 4 and 5 of chapter 1, because just in case they sin. He covered all the bases. He did everything he could to be right with God and use his riches in a proper way. He made every effort to be right with God and with men. And he could not have imagined what was going to happen. No way could he have ever imagined what was to come. So as we continue the story, very early here in the story, the biography of Job is pretty short. I mean, we learn a lot about him through the conversations, things that continue, but it's relatively short. Again, Job was that man, blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned from evil. But then Satan comes in. Starting in verse 6. "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them." He's not one of the sons of God. He came in among them. When they came in, Satan came in with them. I think many of you know that Satan can also be called the adversary. That's what it technically means. So really, he is the Satan. He is the adversary. He is the accuser. We learn that from Revelation chapter 12. We learn that he's the accuser of the brethren. That's his job. He's also the devil. The devil, diabolos, means to separate, to split. That's his work. He was trying to split Job off from God. He's trying to separate Job from God. That's his job, basically. That was his job. And so he levels this charge or this challenge to God. Verse 7. "The Lord said to Satan, 'From where have you come?' Satan answered the Lord, 'From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it.'" That's an interesting picture. "And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Same thing we saw in verse 1. God just repeats that. This is who Job is. Verse 9. "Then Satan answered God and said, 'Does Job fear God for no reason?'" That's one of the most cynical statements made in the Bible. What he's saying is, of course, he serves you. Look at all the stuff he's got. Look at what you've given him. You've given him this plethora of stuff. So Satan challenges God and says, Job is only serving you because he thinks you're blessing him. You're blessing him with stuff. You take away the stuff, Job will stop serving you. He goes on, verse 10, have you not put a hedge around him, like a border, and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch him, touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face, he says. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Satan can't do whatever he wants. He's not omnipresent or omniscient. He can only do what God permits him to do. He allows Satan to tempt. We see that in the Garden of Eden when they came to Adam and Eve. He allows Satan some leeway to do these things. But he's not invincible and he's not irresistible. He can be resisted. But God gives him the right to do this, the permission to do this. What that tells me, just as kind of a preliminary observation, is that he trusts Job. If he's giving Satan this specific permission to do this, then he trusts him. So the narrative, as it plays out here, is pretty dramatic, because it happens one thing after another, and it's from all directions. You have the Sabians come from the south, fire comes from the heavens. And then the Chaldeans come from the north. And we'll see in a bit, this wind comes from the east. But they're just coming like this, just one after another. And then the Scirocco wind comes. Behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house. And it fell upon the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. In each case, there is one servant who was alone to come and tell what happened. This statement is made over in Job 9:18. He will not let me get my breath, he says. All this is coming in rapid succession, one after another. He loses his stuff. He loses his cattle. He loses his... And then finally the house breaks down and he loses all his kids. Can you imagine? He will not let me... And he's talking about God here because he doesn't know what's going on. He says he just will not let me get his breath. So let's look at Job's first response to all of this. Down in verse 20. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. Would that be your first response? If you just lost your family, your house, every possession you had, would that be your first response? I can't imagine what I might do in that case. But he then makes this famous statement. He says, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. I told you that God trusted Job, and therefore he gave Satan permission to tempt him, permission to take away his things. And he passes that test so far, doesn't he? He clearly passes that test. So when you look at this, and we're seeing this integrity of Job emerge that we know is there because of what God said about him. So Satan fails that time, so he tries again. And so he comes into God again, and he says, at second verse of chapter 2, the Lord said to Satan, from where have you come? Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and walking in. That must be his job. That's Satan's pastime. He walks up and down to and fro from the earth, and that's what he does. And he says then in verse 3, have you considered my servant Job? You remember this from the first time. God is the one that brings it up. You know, there's a lot of evil in the world, God says, and you look around, but have you considered Job? Look at Job. He's proof that evil does not have to win. Well, and then he proved it again. Job maintains his integrity throughout all these disasters that befall him. So he brings it up again, Job 2:3. Have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God, turns away from evil. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason, without cause. So this is going to be Satan's second assault. He's going to come in and he's given permission to strike the person of Job without killing him. What do you think? Just think along with me here. Do you think that Job would rather have been killed or go through what he had? I mean, I think that's an easy answer. He would rather have died. Turn over to chapter 3. Just look at what he says after he's struck with these loathsome sores, these boils. Don't want to be too gross, but they're just these weeping, pussy bumps all over him. And so here's his thoughts after this. He says in chapter 3, this is Job, he opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived, let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of months. Behold, let the night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those who curse it curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning. Because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb, and expire? That's what Job wished had happened because of what he's going through, the terrifying difficulty he's facing at this point. So he goes from this to this. Now he's scraping at his boils, some of those had hardened, and he's scraping at those with a piece of pottery because they itch all over. This is Job's lot. This righteous, upright, blameless man is suffering like this. And you think it's over, but then there's one more. His wife says to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. So, at insult to injury, the wife says, die. Now, there may have been some compassion built in there. I don't know. It's hard to say, especially looking at Job's response. But maybe she thought, too, well, he'd be better off if he would just die. But that's not going to happen. And when Job responds to her, back up in chapter 2, verse 10, he said, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we not receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? Shall we receive good from God and not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So the final straw, he suffers all this. His wife even says, curse God and die. She's given up on him. And Job stays the same person. He is the same person. He has a lot of complaining. He's going to complain a lot. There's a lot of things he's going to have to say after this, but he is in trouble, but he maintains his integrity. No sin. Didn't sin. Didn't blame God. So his friends show up. Chapter 4, his friends show up, and I'm not going to go through all of this. There are three friends to start with, and one joins later on. There's just one comment I'm going to make on his friends, because I thought this was kind of interesting. Zophar, one of the friends, his name in Hebrew means to chirp. And so he was like tweeting. he was like chirping at Job. And he was the one that was most severe in his critique of Job. And they certainly did that. Their advice was absolutely ridiculous. Because what they said was, you must have done something particularly horrible for all of this to come down on you. That was kind of the Hebrew view of things. We think, and some I hear people say this once in a while still, I think they say it tongue in cheek when I hear it from my brethren, but they say, well, you know, I must be doing something right because look at what I got. Must be doing something right. Or maybe they think that somehow, if things are going badly, they've messed up in some respect, in some way. I think some of these things are in the back of our mind. It didn't just come on the Jews, you know, just kind of like they were the only ones that thought this sort of thing. You can see it in pagan worlds as well, when they think that gods are mad, therefore I'm suffering somehow. But that's ridiculous. That's just garbage. But that was the argument his friends tried to make. In Job 13, 3-5, he says this, "But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue my case with God," not with you guys. "As for you, you whitewash with lies, worthless physicians are you all. Oh, that you would keep silent, and it would be to your wisdom." These friends were supposed to come and help. Now, remember when they first showed up, they stayed there for 7 days. 7 days and seven nights, and didn't say anything. It would be nice if they did that. You know the saying: if you can't improve on silence, don't say anything. Be quiet unless it improves on silence. And what they had to say was not improving on silence. It was constant critique of him. You must have done something wrong, or this would not have happened to you. There's 30 plus chapters of that. So after all that, God hears a sermon from God. It's out of the whirlwind. Turn to chapter 38, Job 38. I mean, I wish I could preach out of a whirlwind sometimes. That'd be good. Mine are more like mild tropical breezes, maybe. But here's God speaking to Job, and it's a wake-up call for him, clearly. Verse 1 of chapter 38, "The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determines its measurements? Surely you know, or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its basis sunk, or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed limits for it, and set bars and doors, and said, thus far shall you come and no further, and here shall your proud waves be stayed.'" Every time, and I go, we like to go get near the ocean as many times as possible, and when those waves come in, I think about this text. Why do they stop? Why can't I stand from here to there? And they just stop. How does that happen? Why does that happen? It happens because that's the way God made it happen. He's the one that does that. I can't do that. I have no power to do anything that he's talking about here. And that's his argument to Job. Who does that? Who does that? He says in verse 12, "If you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it. It is changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment. From the wicked their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken. Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all this." And he goes on and on with that argument. Who are you? Who are you? Who am I? God says. And he's explaining and revealing to him who he is. And so he's brought up short, as we know, and we'll kind of fast forward. I mean, there's so many good, interesting things here. Chapter 41, verse 1 says, "Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook and press down his tongue with a cord?" We all want to know what Leviathan is. We all have a kind of a curiosity about what that is. But his point is, you can't get him. You can't draw him. I made something so big, you can't catch him with a fishing pole. And so he hears that. With all of that being said, with everything we've said, all that back and forth with his friends, and then God speaking to him out of the whirlwind, what did Job learn? What did he learn? He got an advanced course in knowing God. We just read that. God is the maker of the universe, and he is the one that has to be answered to. Job answered the Lord, chapter 42, verse 1. Job answered the Lord and said, "I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you make it known to me. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you." Whole sermon could be built on that. We hear about God. It comes in. Jesus said many times when he was preaching, he said, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." God, here Job is saying, "I've heard you. I heard you, but now I see you." He didn't see him because he's not going to see him face to face. That's not what he's talking about. He says, "Now I get it. I've heard it, and I did my best, but now I get it." Therefore, he says, finishing this up, "Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." He got an advanced course in knowing God. And we're privy to that. We've got the text. We can look at this and try to somehow crawl into the experience of Job. This is what all these stories and narratives are about, is for us to get inside them and try to put ourselves there and to ask ourselves some difficult, challenging questions. Job learned. He also learned patience. It's interesting that in James 5:1, we were told that Job was patient, but if you actually read from chapter 3 through 37, you don't get the idea. You never get the idea that he was being patient in that sense. But then you stop and think about it. He was patient with his wife. You know, he told her off. But he's patient. He's certainly patient with God and through all he did, even though he talked to him. He believed God was there and listening to him with all his complaints. He never learned. He was kind of patient with his friends. He put up with it. But the word patient typically means to endure something. And that's the sense, I think, in which James uses that term. And then he learned that if you stick with God, things get better. We got to be careful with this. In chapter 42, verse 10, the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he prayed for his friends, and the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. And then he had a great life after this. He died. He had more kids. He died, and he lived happily ever after. Now, that's not going to happen necessarily in our life, so I think we all understand that. But what we do learn is there's something in the end. No matter what we're going through here, no matter what kind of trials, what kind of disasters, tragedy, whatever, this world is not our home, as we sing so often. And I hope we sing it and believe it, because it's not. God has provided something tremendously much better for us. And I like to put it this way, given the song I asked Seth to lead farther along, because I want to make that point. He developed a farther along attitude through this. He did it in a way none of us want to do it. Do you? I mean, I don't think any of us want to go through what Job did. But he developed this farther along, I'll know all about it. Farther along, I'll understand why. And that's for us. The Lord's opinion. This is remarkable. You remember this passage, this little verse over in Ezekiel 14:14? Ezekiel is pronouncing judgment on the nation. And God says to him, said, even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver it but by their own lives and their righteousness, declares the Lord. What he's saying there, I mean, there's obviously the context, is even if they were in it, only they would be saved. Only those three men would be saved. Everybody else in the nation would be lost. That's what God is telling Ezekiel. But what does it say about Job? I mean, what three men would you pick as heroes of faith? And he's right there. I think it's amazing. I love that thought. What do we learn? Suffering is a part of life. Turn to 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 12. 2 Corinthians 12. Unless you are sitting here and never had to suffer a bit, never faced any trial, never had anything, you know, go wrong, it's just a platitude to say suffering is a part of life. We know that. That's what happens. But look how Paul dealt with this. I was just going to kind of starting in the middle here, but in verse 7 it says, so to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited. Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. When you see that term three times in any kind of language from a Hebrew, it means that it multiple times. Just like when Jesus prayed three times in the garden, he probably prayed more than that. And certainly it indicates an intensity of prayer. So he wanted to get rid of that, of course. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weakness, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, with insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I'm weak, then I'm strong. Suffering is a part of life, but there's a point to it. Now, most people in the world do not know this, but if we're going through some kind of legitimate suffering, can be put under that category, we're supposed to be learning. That's supposed to be humbling us. It's supposed to point us to the future, help us think about something other than this life. Because this life, all we can bank on is that at some point we'll have some kind of trial. So our vulnerable or weak spots, whatever they are, keep us from feeling superior. And he describes that to Satan. Satan gave him that thorn in the flesh, whatever that was. We don't know what it is. We learn that perspective is critical. This is really what we're talking about today. If you had to sum it all up, you say, well, you could have done this in 10 minutes. So I could have. But this is really important. Christians have perspective. When someone takes themselves out of this world by suicide or whatever, then they've lost perspective. We know that as a very basic thing. They've lost the perspective that we're supposed to have anyway, and that is farther along. Listen to Romans 8, 17 and 18. He says, if children, then heirs, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed in us. Suffering, any suffering, go down, not to be compared. What are you going to do when you get to heaven? And you say, oh, I had kidney stones. I had several of those. You say, what are those kidney stones going to be when I'm in heaven? That's nothing. That is nothing. They're just not worthy to be compared. I know that's hard when you're in the middle of it, but it's a fact. The other thing is that God trusts us. He is willing to join, listen carefully to this, he is willing to join the battle of good and evil, to pitch the battle of good and evil in the life of free moral agents like us. He is willing to allow us to deal with this and to be tempted because he trusts us. Now, rely heavily, of course, on the grace of God and what Christ did for us, but we are tempted, and he is willing to, with Job, he is willing to say, I'm going to put this in a man I trust and respect. God trusts and respect. I'm going to see how it works out. I'm going to see if he can hold up. And he did. He does that with us. And this whole thing takes place inside us. There's a battle of good and evil inside each one of us. For the desires of the flesh are against the spirit, the desires of the spirit against the flesh. For these are opposed to one another, to keep you from doing the things you want to do. This is the thing knocking its heads. The desire that we have inside to do right bumps head with the flesh, the things in the flesh and the things in the world that tempt us. God trusts us to handle that. We fail sometimes, but he trusts us to handle that. And then when we pass the test, we are his prize. Job was both battleground and prize. Does that make sense? He pitched the battle within Job. He allowed Satan to affect him. Job passed that test. So he was the battleground, but he was also the prize. Now he's a prized possession, if you will, of God because he came through that. It's the same for us. Ephesians 1:18 tells us that we're going to be God's inheritance, that we are God's inheritance. We are God's prize to himself. That's such a profound passage. But when we pass the test, we go through the battle. We're the battleground because it happens in every single one of us. But then we're also God's prize when we pass the test, when we keep our faith and keep our integrity. So another way of saying that, we develop a farther along attitude like Job. And then when we do that, then that's when we get through that and we can keep that perspective and we get to the end, God is the one who will say, oh, welcome into the joy of the Lord. He'll welcome us into heaven at the end of all this. Just don't allow suffering and the trials we go through to pull you down. Try to think about Job and what he went through and how he emerged victorious from that. That's the point of what I want to say this morning. We're going to sing an invitation song. You can put it up. There's a fountain. Our desire here every time we meet is for someone to, or some of you, to think about where you are in your relationship with God. To think about what you might need to do to improve that relationship. And if you're not a child of God, we want you to think about becoming one. Most of us in here have been baptized into Christ. That made us children of God. And now we enjoy that status before God. If you're a disciple, if you've been following Christ, you kind of kept track of what he's doing in your life and read your Bible, those kinds of things, the next step is to become a child of God. And if we can help you with that this morning, then come as we stand and sing.